During the interval, the composer and pianist Stephen Montagu lifts the lid on piano preparation in Here's One I Made Earlier.
One of the unique characteristics of Western music is its obsession with inventing things. In most non-Western cultures, instruments evolve generally very slowly over long periods of time. The builders are usually anonymous. Of course, that happened in Europe too, but over the last 300 years, a trickle of inventions has gradually turned into a flood. The modern piano goes back to Cristofori's first delicate but rather weedy little Italian job, the forte piano. It was built about 1710, and its claim to fame was that it could be played loudly or softly with a simple touch of the hand. Amazingly, within a couple generations, it had grown to full maturity. It was robust, popular, and it could even withstand the best of Liszt's fisticuffs. The piano is basically a percussion instrument. And no matter what anyone says, it's finally a set of hammers whacking a set of strings to make them vibrate. The trick in playing the piano is not so much thundering out chords and arpeggios, but taming its percussive nature to produce a softer side, melting those hammer blows into the illusion of a sustained bel canto style. One day in 1938, John Cage, a young Californian maverick, discovered a hidden voice in his old piano. He opened the lid, wound in a few wood screws, some weather stripping, and a couple of bolts between the strings, and lo and behold, out leapt a torrent of exciting, anarchic, percussive sounds, like nothing ever heard before. In 1938, John Cage's piano experiments blazed a trail for further American sonic adventures. And I'll take a closer look at those wood screws, nails, and bits of weather stripping later on. But his invention of the prepared piano wasn't quite as revolutionary as it first seemed. Another California maverick named Henry Kahl was really the first composer to open the lid and poke around inside the piano. For two centuries, composers had sat happily at the keyboard, satisfied to look no further. But in the early 1920s, Kahl, the tireless sonic explorer, discovered a treasure trove, some amazing sounds hidden under its lid. How about this for 1923? Aeolian harp played directly on the strings of the piano. Here's an excerpt from The Banshee, written a couple years later in 1925. An assistant holds down the right pedal, and the performer stands at the far end of the piano, scraping the strings with his fingernails. Henry Kahl was the real inspiration for the American experimental tradition. Charles Ives and his father were from earlier generations, and probably more radical in many ways, but they were practically unknown until after their deaths. It was Kahl who exerted the most influence on American music in the first half of the 20th century. He was energetic and driven, wrote articles, books, organized concerts, started a new music publishing house, and also managed to compose over 2,000 works, sometimes two or three a day. His interests were global, and his music the same. He was the product of the full California cauldron experience, everything from Asian music to Irish jigs to Anton Webern. He once famously said that he liked living in the whole world of music, not just one corner like the Europeans. And he did. His music is a real blunderbuss of styles and energy. Here's Lou Harrison, a pupil of Cowell's, speaking in 1986.
Henry Cowell was absolutely wonderful. He was, as I've frequently said, central information booth to at least two or three generations of American composers. He also assumed something which I think nobody else assumed, that the world was his big red apple. That is to say, as a 20th century person, it did not occur to him to limit himself to one musical tradition. Therefore, when you studied or heard the ideas of Henry Cowell, the world opened up.
What made me want to laugh when I first knew him was the way he tackled the piano, because he was a small man, and he would go at the piano with great energy, I think much more than was necessary for the effects he wanted. I think partly out of defiance, because he knew that he was going to get a negative reaction and he was going to show them.
Sidney Cowell, his widow, talking in the late 1980s. When Cowell was 16, he invented what is now known as the tone cluster, a spread of notes played with your hands, fist, or forearm. There's also an interesting footnote. When Bartok heard the new arm and fist clusters, he thought they were patented and wrote to Henry Cowell asking permission to use them in his second piano concerto. Here's an early example of clusters used to create the mysterious effect at the beginning of Cowell's Tides of Manaunau, written about 1912. Cowell was one of John Cage's teachers, and Cage freely acknowledges his influence exploring the piano's innards. So what exactly is his prepared piano? Put simply, it's any time you stick objects inside a piano, on or wound through the piano strings. The objects can be anything: wood screws, bolts with washers around them, paper clips, rubber strips, clothes pegs, paper, bottles, anything. Here's Cage recalling how it happened.
I was at the Carnegie School in Seattle, and a beautiful black dancer was going to dance a dance called the Bacchanal on Friday, and on Tuesday she asked me to write the music for it. And at the time when I worked with the piano, I worked with, having studied by that time with Schoenberg, I used 12-tone rows. And I looked for a 12-tone row that had an African flavor, but I didn't find one. So since I was so conscientious, I thought what was wrong was not me, but the piano. And so I went into the kitchen and I got a pipe plate and I put it on the strings. And I saw I was going in the right direction, but the pipe plate bounced around. So then I got a nail and it slipped. And finally I got a wood screw, you know, there were grooves on it, and it stayed in position, and I was able to repeat from one moment to the next the sound as it was transformed by that insertion of the wood screw. And then I put nuts that were larger than the screws themselves so that they would rattle. And then I thought of putting weather stripping under the first string, over the middle one, and under the third. And that made a nice correspondence to the first sound, which was more bell-like. For some reason, I knew that it was better not to have a collection that was entirely beautiful, but that it was nice to have some things in the collection that were distinctly not as beautiful as the others. And that gave a kind of breadth.
So I thought it'd be kind of fun for me to just try this experiment myself. So I'm going to take a pipe plate, set it on the bass strings. I've never actually heard what that sounds like, so let's just see what that's like. There we go. And then play some notes and see what happens. So here's the pipe plate. Okay, that's quite a racket. Cage said that it bounced, which it certainly does, so he thought that maybe he could do something better. He then thought he would try a nail, put that maybe in the upper strings, which, of course, every note on the piano in the upper range has three strings per note, all tuned to the same pitch. So here's a nail, and I'll put this on the E-flat. Wind this gently between the strings. Whoops, bounces, and it slips. When I play it, it sounds just like it would without a nail in it. So Cage discovered this too and decided that maybe what he should do is to try a wood screw. So he took a wood screw, which of course has grooves in it, and he wound that between two of the three strings like this. So I'm winding this into the, you can hear it go into the string. Doesn't hurt the piano, but certainly changes the sound. So here's an E flat. Ooh, nice. Yes, that's more like it. Now, by moving it up and down the string, it changes different pitches. So it changes the node on where the harmonics are heard and makes it sound out of tune with itself. So here we go. I'll move it toward the dampers. Very similar. Ooh, very nice. He then thought, well, why not try a coin between the strings, see if that makes any difference. So I'm going to take an American penny and put that through the strings of a G flat. So let's just try that. So I'll wind this very gently through the strings and then play it. Oh, nice. Like a gamelan. He then thought, well, maybe that's quite an interesting sound. Let's try a washer with the screw. So I'm going to put a screw into the D flat up here and then put a washer around it, and with any luck, the washer will bounce and make a kind of little percussive sound. Let's just see. So here's a D flat. Oh, nice. So we're getting a little, sort of a little American gamelan going here. Then he took a piece of weather stripping, which in the 1940s was a fabric that prevented the air from blowing through your window into your house that was stuck along the window frames. So I'm going to take a piece of that and stick this at the D flat. So I'll wind that between the three strings, and here we go. Let's see what happens. Ooh, creates a harmonic. I'll move it around a little bit, and yes, produces a very nice harmonic. So I have four notes. Let me make this sort of pentatonic and create another sound by winding a bolt in the low D flat on the piano. So I'll take a bolt. These are wound strings, and let's just see what happens here. Oh, nice. Okay, so we have a little gamelan-like instrument. Let me just play a little tune here. In the written scores, the instructions for preparing the piano are very specific. A screw 1 1/4 inches from the damper, a penny 1 7/8, and so on. But they're not as absolute as they look. In 1975, I was playing some prepared piano works at a John Cage festival in Germany. I'd played this set many times and had just recorded them for the BBC. I knew Cage was going to be at the rehearsal, so this time I thought I'd better get the measurements exactly right. I played a Valentine out of season, and at the end, there was complete silence. Cage walked up to me slowly and said, "Do you always play the piece like that?" I hesitated a moment and decided to be honest. I said, "Well, actually, I don't. I usually use your measurements only as a guide and adjust things until they sound rather more interesting." He said, "Thank God for that. When I wrote those pieces, I thought every piano was the same. Of course they're not. And we spent the rest of the rehearsal having fun finding delightful new sounds." Cage's largest work for prepared piano is his Sonatas and Interludes, written in 1948. In composing them, Cage was influenced by Indian philosophy and aimed to express rasas, the permanent emotions. The 16 sonatas and 4 interludes last about 1 hour and 10 minutes and take nearly as long to prepare. They're the culmination of his marvelous invention and demonstrate complete mastery of the new instrument. Here's an excerpt from the 3rd interlude. Thank you. Damn, I wish I'd thought of that. The words of Lou Harrison. Like Cage, a pupil of Henry Cowell. The two young composers had spent time together rummaging around San Francisco scrapyards, hunting for new percussion sounds. And like Cage, he too looked east for inspiration. Harrison's music is often a hybrid of the two cultures, Eastern scales but Western instruments. He reinvented the tack piano, a kind of early prepared piano where metal thumbtacks are stuck into the hammers to give a very special sound, something 18th century American Bach societies often did in the absence of harpsichords. This is from his Concerto in Slendro, written in 1961. But while Lou Harrison was taking preparation in a new direction, by the early 1950s, John Cage had moved on. Before then, his music was extremely rhythmic. The structures were based to a large extent on formulas inspired by his early 12-tone work with Arnold Schoenberg. For some time, Cage had been studying Eastern philosophies, primarily Zen Buddhism, and it changed his life. He claimed to consult the ancient oracle of chance, the I Ching, every day from then on. Chance operations replaced the old structured formulas, ultimately culminating in his famous silent piece, 4 minutes 33 seconds of 1952. A year before that came one of his last prepared works, the Concerto for Prepared Piano and Chamber Orchestra. It embraced the new philosophy in combination with his now well-established invention. Following Cowell, Cage had set in motion a train of innovation that entered the bloodstream of American composers. It seemed that anything was fair game, even toys. In 1948, Cage himself charmed a dance audience with his Suite for Toy Piano, choreographed by Merce Cunningham. In the 1960s, Georgia composer Ben Johnston explored unusual tuning systems with his Sonata for Microtonal Piano. And up in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado, Stephen Scott trains a group of his college students each year to perform full evening concerts playing together inside the bowels of a grand piano. They create what he calls the bowed piano, as multiple strands of rosined fish leader are drawn across the strings. The prepared piano itself will forever be associated with John Cage. The sound is so distinctive that it's easy for composers to feel that it's his territory and avoid writing for it. But it still crops up with some regularity, and now modern technology offers a new kind of preparation. You can electronically modify sounds in any way you want, with delays, filters, ring modulators, flange, reverb. The palette of new sound colors is almost inexhaustible. Here's Cornwall's ambient innovator Aphex Twin, combining prepared piano with electronic effects in a track from his 2001 album, Drooks. The prepared piano may be nearly 70 years old, but it's still very much alive and it's certainly kicking. What's its future? Who knows? But prepare yourself. There are plenty more sound worlds yet to be discovered.
Here's One I Made Earlier was presented by the composer and pianist Stephen Montague. The producer was Alex Galifant.